Well, I want you to pull out a piece of paper or something and write down, think about when you're growing up and write down all of the different household chores that had to be done in your home. Not the chores necessarily that you had, but that your parents did. So any indoor duties, outdoor duties, so it's like laundry, lawn care. So then with your list, just quickly go through and mark an M if it was your mom who generally fulfilled that responsibility, and put a D if it was your dad, or if it was a grandparent or some other guardian, or if you did have a butler, you can put B. Okay, now turn to someone next to you and just sort of share what your household dynamics were and sort of who did what roles and what responsibilities within your household and how the division of labor occurred within your household.
Oh, really?
Let's generate a big list of all the different household chores that you guys came up with, or that when you're reflecting back that had to be done to manage your household. So what were some of them?
Laundry.
Dishes.
Mowing the lawn.
Lawn.
Cooking.
Taking the trash out.
Trash. Cleaning.
Taking care of your pet.
Pet. Okay.
Vacuuming.
Paying bills.
Dusting. Vehicle maintenance.
Going to the store.
Grocery shopping. Groceries and clothes shopping. Raking leaves. Plowing snow. How many of you are in plowing snow households? Snow plowing houses.
Shoveling, yeah.
Cleaning out your closet.
Chauffeur for other siblings.
Chauffeur.
Bringing the mail in.
Getting the mail.
Like maintenance on the house, like washing, like power washing the siding or anything else.
Mulching.
Picking up dog poop.
Sounds like this is getting personal now, like your deep-seated grudges of duties in the back.
Changing light bulbs.
Light bulbs. What about like computer maintenance? Is that like a new household, like my computer's broken or this technology thing? We'll call it tech guru. What is it when your parents would sit on the phone with the, let's say, health insurance people or bill people that takes time? Any others?
Making beds.
Ironing.
Maybe like dressing your kid if you had a young child.
Yes. Dressing kids. Goodness, you just opened up a whole new thing, like diaper changing.
Bathing the kids and putting up.
Oh, yes.
Bedtime stories.
Bathing and nighttime.
So you're disciplining the kids?
Too? Discipline, great. You guys are overwhelming me. I mean, this is its own business, its own full-time job. And also, I have kids. I need to know if you did some of these chores and you were compensated for it and you were compensated through monetary means, what's the going allowance rate? This will help me.
A roof over your head.
A what?
A roof.
Okay, so the range is from zero to $1 room and board. What's the going rate?
I think it depends on the age, because at a different age you think a dollar means a lot more.
That's true. So when you were
marginal.
10, when they were just sort of introducing the idea of, oh, you can make some money.
$5
like a week, or?
$5 for that chore, yeah.
Whoa! So like if you picked up poop, you get $5?
You get $2 for that.
$2. So and when I was growing up, the way it worked, we started self-babysitting. So I have two older brothers, and I think I got paid 25 cents an hour, and my middle brother got paid 50 cents, and the oldest brother got paid $1. But it was on one condition, that when my parents came home, we all had to be in agreement that we didn't have any issues while they were gone. So if there was some sort of internal fighting or squabbling or teasing or annoying, and we couldn't come to an agreement, then none of us would get paid. But then we also had this game that we played growing up called King, Guard, and Prisoner. My oldest brother was the king. My middle brother was the guard. I was the prisoner. The king would send an edict to the guard saying, go and torture the prisoner, guard. And so then the guard would go and torture me. And then the king would say, relent, relent. And so so that was part of our household responsibilities and duties. But I am trying to figure out what an appropriate allowance or wage is. And fortunately, my kids are still at the age where coins are more valuable than paper in their mind. So they're more excited by getting coins than they are by papers with big numbers on it. When we look at this whole scope of responsibilities, I want to know sort of the gender breakdown. We can do. So like vehicle maintenance, if your mom did the vehicle maintenance, raise your hand. And if your dad did it, 12. Okay, and we'll do laundry. If your mom did the laundry, generally, raise your hand. So that's everyone except for two. And then, let's see. Oh, who would typically go get the groceries? If your mom would go get the groceries, raise your hand. And if your dad would get the groceries, raise your hand. Let's see, the general yard work. If your mom did the yard work, raise your hand. Three. Let's say dressing the kids in the morning. If your mom would dress you in the morning, up until what age? No. So if your mom would dress you at the age when you had to be dressed, if your dad dressed you, raise your hand.
Zero.
One of my biggest chores is making my kids lunches in the morning. I'm running out of steam because I also, when they come home from school, I see what they've eaten and what they haven't eaten. And it's just so frustrating. I try to ask them what they like, and now one of my kids has a loose tooth, so she says, I can't eat anything hard. So that's eliminated like half or three quarters of the things that I can provide. I'm going to figure it out. Okay, so let's see. Oh, nighttime activities. If your dad did the nighttime activities with you, raise your hand. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Cooking. If your dad did the cooking, raise your hand. 1, 2. Let's see, any other major ones. Who would do the paying the bills? If your mom did the paying the bills, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, if your mom did tech guru stuff, like just sort of, if any of your technology wasn't working, who would you bring it to? If you brought it to your mom, raise your hand. 1, 2. Any observations that you make from this where you're surprised, or maybe you come from a single parent home where, yeah, this was just dad had to do everything or mom had to do everything because she was the only one there. Anything stand out here that just sort of strikes you as being either where your home sort of fit the norm or your home was different growing up? Yeah.
I mean, with my parents, they're divorced. They kind of all, or both did like all of those. So they don't have to vote for those.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, this in many ways highlights the challenges of a single parent home. Because, I mean, you're doing twice as much. Or, you know, because most of these things need to get done. These aren't sort of luxury things that, well, when I get around to it, maybe we'll do it. It's like, no, the dishes need to be cleaned, food needs to be cooked, clothes need to be washed. These are all things that need to be done. And so then this takes time. I mean, all these things. Like, if you added up the total number of hours that it takes to go grocery shopping, to cook food, to wash clothes, all of it takes time. Or chauffeuring around kids, that's real time that takes you out of the workplace or out of just leisure and rest. One of the most interesting statistics that I've seen is that when you have dual income families, women still do a majority of the household responsibility. So if they did this study where they basically took a typical work week or typical week and they said, you know, how many hours are spent dedicated to doing laundry, how many hours are spent dedicated to getting groceries, to mowing the lawn, all these different maintenance things. And they asked, you know, they surveyed all these couples and basically had a checklist of what things do you do and what things does your partner do, and also what's your work situation. And so, you know, when it was just the father working, it was very clear that the woman was more of a stay-at-home mom, and so she took on a lot more responsibilities. And so that wasn't surprising. The surprising finding was when both were working, say, 40-hour work weeks, the woman still did substantially more, consumed many more hours doing household labor or work than the husband or the dad. And so then, you know, a lot of our questions or conversations are about, well, why is there a gender pay gap, and why is there differences for men and women in the workplace? And someone asked a really good question, and I thought it'd be good for us to figure out the answer. And it was, do women make less because of their family roles? Because, you know, they're the ones who's picking up the kids when they're sick. They're the one who needs to have a more flexible work schedule and work part-time. Or are family roles the way they are because women get paid less? So the idea is, well, you know, even with the case that we did on Tuesday, the idea was that, well, if you have the person who's making more money, let's support them to really be able to go to work and dedicate full time to work, and the one who's making less is gonna take care of the kids or be on call for kid duties. And so there's no gender difference with that. It's basically who's ever making more is gonna have less responsibilities at home, and they're gonna be more focused on their career, whereas the person making less, it's going to take the hit and going to have to take time off of work and have more part-time employment or more flexible work that doesn't pay as well. So my question is, in your framework, do you think that women are paid less because of taking on these responsibilities, and so then they're going to be paid less? Or is it because women take on these responsibilities, they're paid less? Does that make sense, the difference of that? Like, what's driving this? Is it because of the gender roles, and then the byproduct of that is you end up getting into a job that doesn't pay as well, or is it because you're in a job that doesn't pay well, so then by default you end up having to do all these chores? So I want you to break up into the class in two camps. So up here is basically saying, because women take on these roles, they're inherently going to get lower paying jobs. Or if you believe, well, women take lower paying jobs, because women have lower paying jobs, the expectation or assumption is that they're going to take on these responsibilities. I know it's a very subtle difference, but it's a significant one that I'm just curious to see what you guys think. So up here is basically saying, because women take on all these responsibilities and they're saying, hey, I want to be sort of doing a lot of the household duties, as a result, I'm going to take a hit in the labor market, come up here. And if you think, well, women are in the labor market with jobs that are lower paying and less responsibilities, so then, as a result, they end up doing a lot more of the household duties. Does that make sense? Put yourself where you think. What you think is the cause and effect. So what's your logic of why you put yourself over in this camp? Yeah?
I just feel like ever since, I don't even know like what to call ever since, but just like family roles in general, before the business world was huge, just like agriculturally, women have always been known to just take care of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's been what's affected them entering the workforce more slowly than the man, and that's why their wages are lower compared to the opposite way.
Mm-hmm. But even if, so yeah, you don't know like ever since or how far back did this go, but if you think about it, each of you are going to enter into the workforce most likely as a single person. So you're going to be on equal ground. and you're going to have sort of the same amount of time in the marketplace. So you're not sort of starting off at a disadvantage where you're like, well, women are just going to be at a disadvantage because they have kids and they have household duties. It's more or less you guys are all on equal footing when you enter the workforce. And so then when you transition, if you transition to getting married and to having kids, it should be 50% of, you know, you just look at, you turn to your partner and say, well, who makes more, who has a more viable career that we want to sort of invest in? Yeah.
Well, I feel like a lot of it, too, has to do with the fact that the woman is the one who has the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it affects her physically, which can sometimes, in serious cases, affect her ability to work.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like it's just the natural, like if she's been kind of not at her full ability for 9 months, then
mm-hmm.
it just makes sense that she's going to be the one to continue on that path.
Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, again, think about it. The main point is, the suggestion is that the careers that you choose are not gendered. So if your partner is a lawyer and is working up in the ranks in the law firm and wants to eventually become partner, even if that person is a woman and has a child, that being removed from the labor force for, let's say, a year isn't really going to affect the trajectory that much. Like, the career as a lawyer is still very viable and very stable and very, you know, one that you'd want to invest in. And so, again, I agree with you that having the child removes you from your competitiveness, but technically only for a year. And then you can redistribute the labor. So I'm curious then, if both partners sort of have equal chance to have viable careers, why is it then all of a sudden does it shift when you are married and you have kids that sort of the default is that the woman's career, for whatever reason, is seen as less valuable? Does that make sense?
I think it's like kind of an ingrained cultural thing that people have internalized, like that stereotype of like, well, women take care of the household and like men bring home the money, and like it's just, it's gone on for so long and it's been internalized into our culture that it's, even if you don't think outwardly like, oh, well, you know, like when we have children, like, you know, I as a woman, like, gonna like, you know, take time off work and like stay home, it's just kind of like that really, really subtle, deep underlying current of like, this is what's expected of you, and if you don't do that, then like people are going to question like your value as a woman and like your value as like a member of the family and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like expected kind of still in our culture.
Yeah. Well, and the reason why I bring it up is I find it just interesting that if you have two people and they're both on a career path, each has an equal chance of being a viable career path, and in fact, you'll probably pair up and partner with someone who has similar ambitions or similar vocational aspirations. So, you know, if you're looking for a salary professional job, you're probably not going to marry someone who is an hourly wage earner. Like, you're probably going to marry someone who's also a professional, college educated with a salary. So, in a sense, you're going to have equal or equivalent career trajectories, Olivia.
One thing my parents did growing up, that kind of like eliminated a lot of that, and so it was like hard for me to answer these questions. We had, I didn't call her like a nanny, but she was like a caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
So that way they could, like, both my parents growing up worked and were both,
uh-huh.
both had an equal chance at moving up in their
uh-huh.
careers. So that's how they kind of eliminated that.
And did that work, I mean, you don't know anything different, but is that appealing to you? Is that how you envision your household, if you have a household?
I guess I've never really thought about, like, if I would do the same thing,
mm-hmm.
but that's just kind of what I grew up knowing.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I didn't see
sure.
either of them. She was just the primary, like the little stuff here and there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I think about with my kids, where they go to school, I think early drop-off is, like, 6 a.m. or some really early time, and then I think it's 6:30 or 7 is the pickup. So technically, you could drop your kids off around 6 a.m. and then pick them up at 6:30 or 7. You know, if both parents are working, that's a long day for kids. you know, just sort of, because they're not at home. They're not, one of the things I realize is that when my kids are in school, they're sort of on. Like, they have to be, like, fully attentive and sort of present so that when they come home, they're kind of going crazy because they've been sort of told to be on, present, and available for that whole school period. So imagine being that the whole day. So the question would be, is it possible, given these sort of implicit gender dynamics, that women actually might be inclined to pick a vocation that would set them up to fit into this pattern of being able to be a household caretaker? So, like, in your mind, when you think about career options, you're actually thinking through a script of, well, one day I hope to get married and would like to have children. And I remember my mom had this type of job which offered a lot of flexibility that seemed appealing, and I'm sort of being skewed into that type of career track. Are women sort of unconsciously selecting vocations that are actually less, have lower paid salary, less prestige, more flexibility than men are? Is that a possibility? That actually it isn't random. It isn't like everyone graduating from IU is going to just have the whole gamut of careers to pick. Is it actually that men and women select different career paths, even with your major? I mean, you can push it back even further. Are you picking a major that is one that sort of would set you up to sort of be in a situation where you could work for a number of years, but then when you have kids, you could pull back and then you could re-enter into the workforce after that? Does that go into your thing, or even for the men, this implicit thing of, you know, I'd really love to do theater or art, but how am I going to support a family doing that? So I'm going to go get a degree in finance or human resource or management that will just allow, you know, it'll just make sure that I can have a paycheck. Are those factors? Yeah.
I think that the first thing that comes to my mind with women is being nurses and teachers,
mm-hmm.
because those are two jobs that offer a lot of flexibility, like summers off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a big reason why you see a lot of, not necessarily professors, but more like high school, middle school, and grade school are predominantly women teachers because of that flexibility.
Yeah. And you think that's it? They're selecting into it because of the anticipated.
I think that's part of it, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. What about for the guys? Does that go into your calculus of, like, one day I hope to have a family, and so I'm going to pick a more conservative path vocationally? Some of you are nodding. What's the calculus that
goes? I feel like as a guy, you need to provide for your family, so you need to have, like, a job that can...
Can do it. So are,
yeah,
and well. Do you see yourself foregoing certain sort of dreams or aspirations? Like, I'd really like to do this, but this is way too risky, and the job prospects are minimal, so I'm going to take this path.
I never thought of that, but I mean...
Well, I mean, I know even with my dad, just vocationally, I had a degree in engineering, and I wanted to go work for a nonprofit organization. Instead of doing engineering, I just wasn't interested in the different engineering jobs. And I remember my dad very specifically said, well, why don't you get at least 2 years of work experience with your engineering degree? Because if you don't, then your degree becomes obsolete and all that sort of education is lost and wasted. And I was like, yeah, but I'm passionate about this and I want to do this. But my dad's voice was there saying, yes, but this is the more logical, conservative, this one would guarantee long-term income to be able to support a family, whereas this one, sure, it might be something you're passionate about, but at the end of the day, it's not going to provide the means necessary for sort of a comfortable lifestyle. But so a lot of these, you know, I guess part of the exercise is to think about the career choices we make are influenced by societal expectations that either we embrace or maybe you push against it and say, well, no, I'm very aware of these societal expectations and I don't want to fall into them. And it's not just expectations on women, it's also expectations on men that influence career decisions. So we can go back to our seats. So when you're 40 years old, what's the job that you would like to have? What career path would you want to be in? What would you want to be doing when you're 40 years old? I'll start here.
Upper management / business owner.
Okay. So business owner or?
One of the two, probably.
Okay.
I'd have to go on business owner too.
Business owner.
Probably business owner too, I have no idea. Human resource administrator, but I kind of wish I would be a business owner. They're pretty cool. So.
Yeah, okay.
I have no idea.
Okay. It should be a category.
I'd say like HR director.
HR.
Business owner.
Business owner.
I'd say like a hiring manager as well.
Okay. Manager.
Business owner.
HR director.
Upper level management.
So the question is, when you're 40 years old, what type of job do you want to have or what do you want to be doing?
Manager.
Manager.
Or like CEO, but I'll go
CEO.
For I'll go for manager.
Okay. Yeah, there's always those lists out there of the top people under 40. So, you know, once you hit 40, if you're not a CEO or not president or something, you're on the back end of your career. So I figured I'd catch people right at their peak in their prime. But so most of these jobs, almost all of them are salaried, and they would vary in levels of flexibility with your work schedule. They vary with the amount of travel. But I think it is helpful to have a sense of what type of job career path do you see yourself on. And what I want to focus on for the remainder of the lecture is what I call the life course of a person's vocational career. And so life course typically is sort of the life course of individuals from birth to death. But within vocations, there's also a life course that intersects that of, at some point, most of you probably get married, and most of you will at least desire to have children or will have children. And that the stages of your life of marriage and household and family intersect with the stages of work. And, you know, a lot of what we've looked at is sort of what is the, there's a shift in society from single income families to dual income families, and that's really shaken up the workforce of how do we accommodate dual-income families. An interesting thing with the household stuff is that I think something in the textbook said 26% of women, married women, make more than their partner, like make at least $5,000 more than their partner, and yet still the division of labor within the household is still skewed towards women doing more. And so a lot of the changes in the workplace have been ways to sort of even the playing field between men and women and the benefits and sort of expectations and obligations. And the first one that we read about and that was had a significant effect was the Family Medical Leave Act, which was basically shifting it to make it possible for women who are having children to get paid time off or at least allowed time off and not losing their job. But this is something that's still in process of, like, many people would argue that we're still not there yet as far as the benefits. And President Obama, just in the last year, initiated taking the Family Medical Leave Act one step further and sort of expanding the benefits and expanding the opportunities. And we're going to look at what the U.S. does and how that compares to other countries in the developed world.
Now to a major new initiative for families from the White House this morning, President Obama proposing new legislation that would require companies to give workers paid sick leave. ABC's Jonathan Carl is at the White House this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Robin. The White House says some 43 million workers in the United States don't have any paid sick leave at all, so the president is calling on Congress to pass a law that will require companies to give at least 7 days of paid sick leave to their employees. He's also asking for $2 billion to be given to the states and cities to help them pass or start their own programs with family and medical leave. And he's acting on his own, making it easier for federal employees to get up to 6 weeks of maternity leave. The president is promising a big push on all of this beginning next week, Robin, with the State of the Union address.
Out of the 196 countries worldwide, there are 7 countries who don't have laws requiring paid maternity leave. Suriname, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Papua New Guinea, Tonga, the United States of America, Palau. Wait, what? Oh, that's right. The good old US of A is the only developed country in the world that doesn't provide new parents with any financial assistance. Sure, there are some companies who have paid leave benefits, but they're few and far between. According to a study from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 11% of women who work at private companies receive paid leave. So what does the US provide? The US government provides 12 weeks unpaid maternity leave with job security. So they do offer something. Except there are strict requirements you must meet in order to get this benefit. And currently, 40% of women do not even qualify for unpaid maternity leave. But the US isn't alone on this, right? How far behind the rest of the world could the US really be? Oh. Well, at least France doesn't offer so much time off. Instead of additional time off, the French government offers a family allowance every month to help pay for child expenses, all the way up until the kid's 20th birthday. In Finland, the government provides every pregnant woman with a maternity care package, which includes clothes and other necessary items required for raising a child. On top of that, the government offers public daycare for any child until the age of 7, or if parents decide to opt out, they're entitled to paid leave for the first 3 years of their kid's life. Paid leave isn't just for mothers. Many countries actually provide paternity leave as well. For example, Swedish law states 8 weeks is reserved for each parent. That means if mom is ready to get back to work after 8 weeks, dad can take the remaining 61 weeks off to take care of the baby. What does the US have again? Oh yeah, job security. Well, everyone else has that too. What do you think should be done about maternity leave?
So if you think about this idea of, again, life course, the first place in which you're going to bump up against a lot of these issues is when you have your first child. And if you think about your family budget and you have dual income, and you're working fine on that, and then you have a kid, and kids cost money, but then you're pulled out of the labor market where you're not being paid, that's going to take a hit on you. Not only are you going to have an increase in expenses, but you're going to have a decrease in wages. And you know, the 11% of women that do qualify for paid leave through their companies, those are pretty high-level positions. And so hopefully you can get to a place where you're in that type of position or working for that type of company, but chances are you won't be. You'll be in a field or industry where the best you'll probably get is unpaid leave. And I'm just, you know, from your perspective, when you see this, there's, you know, one way to interpret it is to say, wow, why is the U.S. so far behind all the other countries in the developed world? Or you could say, no, the U.S. is ahead of the game. You know, they're actually, the U.S.'s system is actually more advanced and more competitive than all of these other countries in the developed world. Just what are some of your reactions when you sort of see the stark differences or the American exceptionalism in terms of maternity leave? What are just some of your reactions to that, Sam?
Did I see this? And I'm no longer wondering why our birth rate is so low. It's like it really deters people from having children with stuff like this.
Okay, but the birth rate in Europe is even lower.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, I would agree with you, and some would say that part of the argument is, oh, if you start offering paid maternity leave, your fertility rates are going to shoot way up. But they've run this experiment, in a sense, where they have developed world, you know, U.S. that doesn't have paid maternity leave, and developed world Europe where they do have it, and actually the fertility rates are lower in Europe, significantly lower. I mean, U.S. is still around 2.1, and there's some countries in Europe where they're not having enough kids to replace the population. So that's why, like, Germany and I think it's Italy are places where they're actually, there's a little bit of a concern that we need to start having more kids if we're going to not only replace people into the labor market, but also then paying for elder care and pensions and Social Security benefits. It's good to point that out, but I'd actually say that's probably a reason, or that's a, people would say that as a reason of not having paid maternity leave, because then people would be having kids all the time. That's probably, it's, that's not a good argument. I know that's not the argument you're making, but Olivia.
I just have a question. So in those other countries, are there female ratios in the workforce much higher than ours? Like, does that affect that?
So is your thought that they have more female in the, and so they're...
I'm wondering if they do because of the benefits they offer.
Oh, I see. Because they offer the benefits, more women can go into the workforce. I don't know the actual statistics. I'd have to look. And you're saying that because of these generous benefits that more women go into the workforce.
Well, I would think they would be inclined to.
Uh-huh.
But that could be wrong.
But then I'd also say the proportion of women going into the workforce in the U.S. is pretty high, and it's continuing to grow. So I mean, at the end of the day, the decision to go into the labor market or not is driven by financial need versus, I could give or take getting a job, but if I have paid leave, then I'm going to go do it. I don't know if that truly affects the proportion of women in the work. I mean, just because you kind of have to work anyway. So, but it would affect maybe what vocations they go into or what careers they go into. Any other just sort of reactions to this where, you know, if there's a bill on the floor of let's catch up with the other countries in Europe, is there anyone who would say, I would be opposed to that? Because on Tuesday when we did the exercise, a majority of you said that businesses should not make special accommodations for families. So it's basically what happens in these other countries is the government mandates. The example here was, you have Google and Disney and a couple of companies that have very generous maternity and paternity packages, but they're not required to. Whereas in the developed world, every company is required to, and it's just part of their business model. One of the strongest arguments against it, against mandating it, is that it puts these companies at a competitive disadvantage to offer maternity leave. And The Economist did a study on sort of looking at, is it, you know, what type of a financial hardship or sort of financial outcomes are a result of offering generous maternity and paternity leaves. And I found this interesting because in general, The Economist tends to have a more conservative slant. Like they want good fiscal policy. They want good, something that makes good business sense. And so when they came out with this study, it caught my attention because if you are making the argument that it's fiscally irresponsible and it's not good business sense, looking at this study provides a nice counterbalance to that type of argument. And it's from someone that you wouldn't necessarily expect to make this type of argument.
Despite decades of social progress in the workplace, women still have to contend with the lion's share of childcare. While most countries allow up to 3 months of maternity leave, only around half a dozen countries offer fathers more than 2 weeks paternity leave. In Denmark, 90% of dads take more than a fortnight's leave. Research suggests that enabling fathers to look after their newborn children has positive knock-on effects. What are the benefits of paternity leave? First, fathers who take paternity leave are more likely to take an active role in childcare tasks. According to a study of 4 rich countries, America, Australia, Britain, and Denmark, fathers who had taken paternity leave were more likely to feed, dress, bathe, and play with their child long after the period of leave had ended. Danish men were the most diligent. 77% of them play with their children. Second, this early interaction has longer-term benefits for a child's learning abilities. A study by the University of Oslo found that paternity leave improved children's performance at secondary school. Daughters, especially, seemed to flourish if their dads had taken time off. But this tends to benefit children whose dads come from more advantaged backgrounds. Most paternity leave tends to be short and poorly paid, so richer dads are more likely to take the time off. Third, paternity leave is good for women's careers. When childcare responsibilities fall exclusively to the mother, the effect is to depress women's wages. Time out of the labour force deprives them of experience and promotions. When men shoulder more of the childcare burden, the effect is lessened. For years, the priority of the women's rights campaigners has been to increase the provision of maternity leave. These days, more governments are starting to believe that the best way to improve women's career prospects is instead to turn to the dads.
It's interesting, if you think about historically, society was a much more agrarian society where pre-industrial revolution, everyone worked more or less at home or on the homestead. Like, there wasn't this idea of going to work in the morning or going into the city for employment. But it was, everything sort of existed within sort of the home, homestead, or you know, small business within in the community. And so mothers and fathers were both with their kids throughout the day. And so it's only in the past, I'll say, 100 years or 120 years, this idea of dad goes to work and mom stays home with the kids. It used to be work and everything sort of a lot of times happened, or for a large majority of the population, happened at the home and self-sustenance. And so the idea was both parents were equally engaged with the students. It was still gendered in the sense that maybe the father and the sons would go off into the field and do outdoor chores, in a sense, and the mother and the daughters would do indoor stuff. But it wasn't completely stark like that. But the idea was that both parents were engaged in raising the kids. And so it's only a recent phenomena that, in a sense, fathers are sort of removed from this. And we come to think, well, that's normal. That's just the way it is. Like, it seems strange for the father to be doing some of these child-caring activities or engagement with their children. But actually, historically, the norm was both parents being around and present versus the father sort of being separated out. And it gets even more complicated if you pull both parents out and you look at the proportion of kids being raised. They get more FaceTime with their nanny or a non-family member caretaker than they do with their own parents. And this isn't necessarily good or bad, but I want to point out that it isn't something that's always been the case. And so don't just sort of casually lapse into it. Well, that's just what you do. You get a nanny or you put your kid in childcare from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. so that you can fulfill your career aspirations. A lot of it is thinking through, well, okay, what are my holistic aspirations? And also, ultimately, do I want to go work for a company that would actually promote this idea of a work-life balance or be family-friendly, even at the expense of maybe my bottom line of how much I get paid would be a little bit less? Because all of this, at the end of the day, will affect your salary, or if you're running your own business, it costs money to offer these benefits. But maybe the long-term benefits exceed the cost of that. Probably my deeper concern, most of you talk about wanting to have professional careers with salaries. My greater concern is for the lower income, less educated families, because they don't even have the luxury of picking and choosing the types of jobs or careers that they want to have nearly as much as you do. And so then when they go into the workforce and when they have kids, they feel the hit a lot more. Because in many ways, if you have one of these jobs, whether you're a man or a woman, you could probably get by with one of you working for, you know, a short period of time with the younger years of your kids. But if you're working an hourly job, you don't have that luxury. And especially if you're working two jobs. You know, a lot of people who are being paid minimum wage, they have two jobs. So, you know, you think a 40-hour work week, yeah, it's, you know, that takes a lot of time. Imagine working two jobs just to make ends meet if you're a single parent or you're in a situation where only one of you can work. So what's interesting with paternity and maternity leave from a human resource perspective, I found this very interesting. My neighbor in North Carolina, he's a professor, and the university offered paternity leave, a semester off. I mean, it's a very generous package, and it was, you know, sort of held up on the pedestal of like, hey, this is, we're very progressive, we're very family friendly. And so his wife was pregnant, they're about to have a kid in August, and so I said, wow, you get the whole semester off. Basically, no teaching, no committee work, it's just, it's paid leave for an entire semester. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm not going to take it. And I was like, what? Why aren't you taking, this is paid leave. He's like, well, in my department, I would catch so much flack if I actually took the paid leave. And he felt this sort of obligation to his department to not leave. Because basically when he leaves, someone has to teach his classes, someone has to sit on his committees. And so here the university was offering this very generous paternity leave package, possibly with the knowledge that people actually wouldn't take it. So literally, this person was being offered 4 months of paid leave where he didn't have to teach, didn't have to do any committee work, and he turned it down. Because of the culture, the organizational culture was such that there was too much peer pressure for him to basically not take the paternity leave. And so I found that fascinating, that from an organizational perspective, the university looks great because they offer a very progressive and generous paternity leave package, but then the organizational culture was such that you better not take that. And nothing was ever explicitly said, but he knew that, well, gosh, I'd be letting down my colleagues and they would feel like I'm taking the easy way out. And again, so you can even have these policies and have generous packages, but I would argue that that organizational culture was flawed in the sense that here the university presumably is wanting to do something that's helpful and beneficial, but then internally there's so much pressure to not do that. And so then it, you know, the potential benefits are lost on the people. So another thing that comes up in the workplace, and this actually happened at my previous university, where, you know, there's a kitchen, a faculty kitchen, and there's a refrigerator, and one of the moms had just had a child, and she was breastfeeding her child, and so when she was at work, she couldn't, her kid was in childcare, so she would pump. And so if you ever seen your mom or know people who are pumping, you basically, like, your body produces milk, and so then she would pump the milk and then put it in the refrigerator in the faculty kitchen. And so then there was an email buzz that went around saying this is inappropriate to have breast milk in the refrigerator, and she's kind of like, well, where am I supposed to put it? Like, if I don't put it in the refrigerator, then it's going to go bad, and then I can't, and then I have, you know, biologically I have to do this throughout the day. What was fascinating was it created this conversation, slightly awkward, but a very real social fact of when you have kids. And so when we talk about the life course of a career, this is one of the things that if you're running an organization or if you're part of HR, what do you do when someone has just had a child and they're nursing their child? What do you do? And so I found an interesting video that talks about how this plays out in the workplace.
I'm from Malawi, Africa, so I was raised in the United States, and in my culture, breastfeeding is just part of who you are as a woman and as a mom. So it wasn't optional for me. This is just who I am. And when I came back from maternity leave, I really wanted to continue breastfeeding. And I said, okay, well, now I'm going to have to pump at work. And how am I going to do this? And where am I going to have it? And where am I going to store the milk? I just had a lot of anxiety really regarding continuing to breastfeed. And when I came back, it was really odd. I went to one of my coworkers who was a new mom. She had her child the previous year. So I said, well, where did you go to pump? She's like, there was no place to pump. I just went to the bathroom. I said, oh, no, 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 we can't be having that. Our biggest challenge when we took this project on was our workspace is an open workspace. So even our president and CEO works out of a cubicle. And the solution that we came up with was to use a multifunctional space. So a room that also doubles as sort of a file room slash mail room. And then it was our job to make sure that we communicated the priority of the use of the room, that a nursing mother would certainly have priority over the other functions of the room. Really, it was PYN's decision to say, okay, we have a need, somebody came to us, and we definitely want to make sure she's comfortable, and they met that need. We definitely learned that there was some stigma attached to saying the word breastfeeding at work. The more we talk about it, the more comfortable it becomes to people because it stops being shocking. The staff that haven't had children, they're realizing, well, you know, this is a need. You have to embrace that need. You have to value really how you help other staff have a balanced work life.
I think we had a program before in spirit, and now we feel like we have one that is more formal, and we realize it's really not about the bells and whistles. It's about having the right attitude about it.
When you take care of your employees, they take care of you. And one of the things that has resulted from having a lactation program at PYN is I really have a different sense of loyalty to my organization because I don't know if this is something I would get elsewhere. If I'm looking for a place to work, I'm not just looking at the financial benefits. I'm also looking at what kind of environment is it? Is it supportive enough? You know, does it help me in terms of supporting my family physically, emotionally, and all that? Because I need to be available for my family as a working mom. So I think it's very, when you invest in a lactation program, it's a mutually beneficial return.
This is a topic which is one where people get squirmish or like, I don't, you know, not at work or not anywhere. I don't want to talk about this stuff. And yet every one of you, you know, and if you have children, will go through this reality. And what I find interesting is imagine this organization or a organization is run by all men and you're a female employee who's just had a child. And you're kind of like, okay, how do I navigate this? How do I advocate for myself or let these people know that I need some accommodations for nursing or breastfeeding? And what shifts, when it's an entire group of men, it's kind of like there's going to be comical statements or dismissiveness or even statements of, well, yeah, that's why women shouldn't be here. It just confuses things or complicates things or it's gross, or, oh, yeah, that's not, you know, just it's complicated, and the idea is just to dismiss it or ignore it or pretend, you know, sort of push it away, push it off onto someone else, whereas if you have women in positions of leadership, they're going to create a culture that's like, hey, this isn't gross or awkward, this is just natural, this is something that is a reality for anyone who has a newborn, and so how do we make accommodations for this, but it allows for a more normalized conversation and discussion about potential policies. So yeah, I mean, even I thought it was interesting in this video, the place where they set aside where you could actually nurse your child said, mom at work. You know, it wasn't like, this is the breastfeeding room, or something that was more stigmatized. But this is just sort of one slice of the realities of a greater proportion of women in the workforce, but not only just women in general in the workforce, but women who have recently had children. So it used to be women would be in the workforce, but then when they would have kids, they would leave the workforce. But now there's a higher proportion of women with newborns in the workforce. And so then organizations have to adapt and accommodate for them. They don't have to, but these are the questions that get raised when you talk about diversity. So diversity isn't just gender diversity, but it's what stage of the life course are these women at? And the next thing, after you have a kid, then eventually you put your kids in childcare. And what I find interesting is that's probably one of the most complicated things for families. How many of you growing up spent some time, whether you know at a very young age or after school time, in some form of structured childcare? So not necessarily a parent or an occasional babysitter, but where you're dropped off at childcare. So if you're in childcare in some way, raise your hand. So just like 3 total? Most likely, if you have kids, childcare will be something that you'll have to navigate. And I'm just curious if What would you guys guess that childcare cost? An annual, like if you had one child in childcare during the typical workday, how much do you think that would cost? You know, the idea is if both parents are working and you have a two-year-old kid and you need to put the kid in child care, what do you think it would cost?
About like $9,000 a year.
$9,000? What else? What would other people say?
I was going to say 12.
12.
15.
15. Okay, so the average, and this would vary by location, is $12,000 a year. So think about what your salary is, or even if you're going into the workforce, and then you need to sort of, it's an added tax of $12,000 taken off the top. How much, if you're working minimum wage, 40 hours a week, how much do you think you make? What would be your annual salary if you were working minimum wage? What did you say?
Is it like 15 or something?
15,000, that's before taxes. I think it, after taxes is around 13,900. So 15, let's say $14,000 minimum wage, 40 hours a week. And you have a child that you put in child care. That costs $12,000. It makes it really difficult. I mean, these are like no-win situations when you think about the idea of, again, this really hits the lower-income people. And you guys are very fortunate to be getting a college education, but roughly 25% of the population has a bachelor's degree or more. So it isn't... It isn't the overwhelming majority that have college degrees. It's actually a lot more have less than a bachelor's degree. 75% have less than a bachelor's degree. And so when we think about these policies, you might sit here and think, well, I'm safe, I'm clear. But what about the people who don't have the benefits of a college education? Now, you could sit there and say, well, it's their fault that they don't have a college education. Again, when we talk about there's some individual explanations for why people don't have a college degree, but there's also structural explanations. There are some things that make it much less likely for a person to get a college degree than other people because of structural factors. But a lot of things, when we talk about work and family, they strongly influence gender career options, gender salaries, but they also then affect all of us in the sense of how do we approach the types of jobs that we want to pursue and working for organizations that are family friendly. Because I'd say at the end of the day, you're going to value your career, but your life isn't your career. And so how do you pursue jobs that would actually allow you to live out your desires for a more holistic life versus my friend who's at a university where he gets paternity leave, but the culture is such that you better not take it. Okay, that wraps this up for today, and I'll see you guys on Tuesday.